Tomorrow evening, lows 42 to 46. Looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s.
I realize that President Trump, who does no reading and doesn't understand anything, uses the words Insurrection Act like he understands it, but he doesn't.
President Trump says the National Guard is needed in Chicago. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker says it's an invasion.
For Tuesday, October 7th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. In Venezuela, dozens of foreign nationals remain locked up without trial, along with hundreds of Venezuelan political prisoners.
Human rights groups say they're being used as hostages.
It appears that the Venezuelan regime is holding these foreigners to extort foreign countries, forcing them to engage with Maduro.
And it's the height of the fall migration season.
As birds take flight, one of the biggest threats they face is glass.
I mean, they can be flying like up to 30 miles an hour when they hit the glass. So it's a very loud thunk.
How to prevent those crashes after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. President Trump is warning there might not be back pay for some of the 750,000 federal workers furloughed during the government shutdown. That would be a reversal of a policy he himself signed into law in his previous term. Trump said some people, quote, don't deserve to be taken care of. Texas National Guard troops are in Chicago today to support federal immigration enforcement at the request of President Trump. Blaise Gainey reports from the Texas newsroom.
Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker condemned the move as an invasion and urged Texas Governor Greg Abbott to withdraw support. But Abbott has backed Trump's decision and posted photos of Texas Guard members boarding planes, calling them elite and ever ready. Normally, governors control their National Guard units, but the president can federalize them in rare situations, a power the Trump administration argues is justified by what they call rebellion against federal authority. The administration says the troops are needed to protect federal personnel and property as immigration enforcement intensifies. I'm Blaise Gainey in Austin.
Today is the second anniversary of Hamas's attack on Israel that led to Israel's war in Gaza. In Egypt, negotiators are meeting for a second day of talks aimed at ending the conflict. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports.
Egypt's foreign minister says talks in the Egyptian resort town of Sharm el-Sheikh continue involving Israeli and Hamas officials. He says the aim is to negotiate the first phase of the deal, including an Israeli troop redeployment to allow for the release of hostages, delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza, and the release of Palestinian prisoners. U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff tells NPR he will join the talks in Egypt tomorrow. A Qatari government spokesman says mediators also want to work out the details of an international peacekeeping force deploying in Gaza. A person in the region close to the talks, not authorized to speak publicly, tells NPR a breakthrough is likely within a week or two. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Federal Reserve Board Governor Stephen Miron says keeping interest rates too high could pose a risk to the U.S. economy. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Trump White House economist turned central banker spoke to a group of financial managers in New York today.
President Trump has been pushing the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates more aggressively, and his latest appointee to the Fed Governing Board has been echoing that view. Stephen Miron, who joined the Fed Board in September, cast the lone vote that month for a supersized rate cut. He also projected two more jumbo rate cuts by December, a forecast far more aggressive than anyone else on the Fed's rate-setting committee.
One reason for why my, you know, sort of dot for 2025 sticks out so much from everyone else's is because I'm more sanguine on the inflation outlook than a lot of other people are.
Miron says he expects housing costs to cool, and he doesn't believe Trump's tariffs will cause much of a jump in prices. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News from Washington. Officials say HelloFresh subscription meal kits may contain spinach that's been contaminated with listeria. The U.S. Agriculture Department is warning people not to eat the ready-made meals, including cheesy pulled pork pepper pasta and unstuffed peppers with ground turkey. The products were shipped directly to consumers' homes. This year's Nobel Prize in Physics has been awarded to three University of California scientists. Their work demonstrated the quantum mechanical effects in electrical circuits. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports this could help develop better computers.
The three researchers who won the prize are John Clark, Michel Devoret, and John Martinez. In the mid-1980s, they did experiments that showed how a subatomic phenomenon, quantum tunneling, can be observed on a macroscopic scale, involving many particles on a chip. At a press briefing, Clark said he was stunned that they won.
We had not realized in any way that this might be the basis of a Nobel Prize.
The prize committee at the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said their advances could lead to the next generation of quantum technologies, including quantum cryptography and new kinds of sensors. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
30 Bob Ross paintings will be auctioned to support public TV stations. Ross died in 1995. He was famous for his permed hair and gentle demeanor on his Joy of Painting show, which ran for 11 years. The programs had a resurgence of popularity during the COVID lockdowns. The auctions come as Congress cut $1.1 billion in public broadcasting funding. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's 5:06. Programming is supported by Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative, providing the energy to help power ideas and strengthen rural development throughout northern Minnesota. More at lakecountrypower.coop. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives. Temperatures below freezing tonight, 26 to 30. Sunny tomorrow, highs 58 to 64. More news is next.
Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. The clock is ticking for Chicago and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. President Trump has deployed the National Guard to the country's third largest city, and he says they will begin operations no later than Wednesday. Pritzker, a Democrat, has called President Trump's efforts a, quote, invasion. And along with Chicago's Mayor Brandon Johnson, he is fighting the administration's efforts in the courts. Governor J.B. Pritzker joins me now. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Juana.
Thanks for being here. Governor, we're speaking on Tuesday morning, and the Trump administration has said that troops will be on the ground no later than tomorrow. You have filed suit against this move, but the judge declined to block the deployment. There will not be a hearing until Thursday morning. So I just want to start by asking you, how are you preparing for the fact that the National Guard could well be on the streets of Chicago as this lawsuit is playing out?
Well, let me be clear that the judge is actually deciding this on Thursday and hasn't declined anything. She's literally reading the filings and demanded that the federal government submit something by Wednesday so that she could make a ruling potentially on Thursday. We don't know how she will rule, but I certainly, based on the precedent of what occurred down in Oregon, we believe that we'll get the rule that we want. I remember that we are seeing National Guard troops coming from Texas now. We have our own National Guard that have been federalized, and the Texas National Guard were already federalized, so that's why they were able to move quickly. And they've already started arriving, not in Chicago, but in Joliet at a federal facility there. The federal judge, though, warned the federal lawyers that it wouldn't be a good idea for them to deploy them until there is a ruling.
Your state's attorney general has argued that the deployment of the military to Illinois is unlawful and constitutional, no matter where these forces come from. But the Trump administration, for its part, says that it is deploying troops to assist federal agents with immigration enforcement. So have officers been able to carry out ICE enforcement duties without support of local law enforcement?
They have, and they are carrying out those duties. I will say that they are doing them. They're carrying it out in an extremely aggressive fashion that borders on breaking the law, federal law and state law. But ICE agents and Customs and Border Patrol are on the ground, and they have been effectuating their plan. The thing is, they're using literally people's skin color as a way to determine whether they're going to stop people and ask them for their papers. Now, think about that. I don't walk around with papers to prove that I'm a U.S. citizen. I bet you don't either. Most people don't. But they're demanding that, well, if you happen to have, you know, something other than white skin, you better have something to prove it or you're going to get detained or arrested.
Governor, President Trump said on Monday that at the moment he doesn't plan to, but that if governors like yourself and the courts do not cooperate with his administration's efforts, that he would consider invoking the Insurrection Act, which would give him broad latitude to use the Guard or active duty troops for law enforcement in Chicago, not limited to protecting federal agents. How serious of a threat is that?
Well, remember, the Insurrection Act has the name insurrection in it for a reason. It's only something that you can effectuate if there is an insurrection, a foreign invasion, a true national emergency. That doesn't exist here, and it doesn't exist in Portland. It didn't exist in Washington, D.C. or in Los Angeles. So I realize that President Trump, who does no reading and doesn't understand anything, uses the words Insurrection Act like he understands it.
The president
it, but he
might
doesn't.
Disagree with your characterization there. He has argued that it is emergency. He has described it looks like war in some of these cities.
Yeah, but he's the one that's causing that situation. That is to say, it's ICE and CBP that have been launching grenades with tear gas, that have been pelting people with plastic or rubber bullets. They're the ones that are creating mayhem on the ground specifically because they want to claim that there's some sort of emergency. There isn't. This is occurring in a two-block area of a suburb of Chicago, Broadview. So, yes, they can take their own video of an incident that occurs, in that two-block area and make it seem like that's all of Chicago. That's not even in the city of Chicago. In fact, our crime rate has been dropping and dropping at, half the homicide rate that it was a few years ago. Double-digit declines each year now. Donald Trump he honestly doesn't read. He doesn't understand what's going on in the cities. He just has some notion in his head. There's some sort of dementia going on, and he just keeps repeating things from years gone by.
Governor, as I listen to you talk about the Insurrection Act or the restraining order that your state has filed, it sounds to me like you're in many ways relying on how things have been in the past. And if there's one thing we've seen, it's that the courts have appeared quite willing to increase the power of the president. Are you concerned about where all of this could be going?
Sure. And I think we have to rely on the courts and get rulings that are, uphold the Constitution and the law. Unfortunately, we have a system in which the Supremacy Clause says that the federal government's laws essentially override state laws if they're in direct contravention. And also there's immunity for federal agents from the federal government for much of their activity. So we don't do that on the ground. We don't hold everybody immune. Sometimes we do in certain things. But what we can't do is just sit idly by while these things are occurring. And that's why we've called on people to take action, like creating evidence for our court cases by pulling out their iPhones and their Android phones and filming everything. We wouldn't even know about the alderman who was detained by ICE for simply standing and asking them questions. She was truly docile in the entire manner. It's on film. We wouldn't know about that if someone hadn't pulled out their phone to take video of it. And we need to find ways to hold them responsible. Private organizations, private legal organizations like the ACLU are doing that now. And to the extent that states and local governments can do so, we are.
Governor J.B. Pritzker, Democrat of Illinois, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Juana.
Earlier this year, the Trump administration made a high-stakes swap, treating more than 200 Venezuelan migrants held in a notorious Salvadoran prison for 10 Americans jailed in Venezuela. But dozens of foreign nationals remain locked up in Venezuela without trial, along with hundreds of Venezuelan political prisoners. Human rights groups say they are being used as hostages at a time when U.S. warships patrol the shore off the Venezuelan coast, and pressure on Caracas intensifies. Manuel Rueda has the story.
Manuel Alejandro Tique used to live in this peaceful condo on the outskirts of Bogotá. Now he's in a maximum security prison in Venezuela, where inmates are rarely allowed to communicate with the outside world. We're constantly worried about how he's doing, says his sister Diana Tique, whether he's eaten or whether he's sick. Dozens of foreigners are currently in prison in Venezuela, where they've been accused of plotting to overthrow President Nicolas Maduro. But human rights groups say that most of these prisoners have nothing to do with Venezuelan politics.
It appears that the Venezuelan regime is holding these foreigners to extort foreign countries, forcing them to engage with Maduro, a government that they have criticized for stealing the elections in 2024.
Juan Papier is the Deputy Americas Director at Human Rights Watch. He says that there are currently 89 foreign prisoners in Venezuela from countries that include Colombia, Spain, Argentina, Luxembourg, and the Czech Republic. Most have been taken after last year's controversial election.
We've seen some people detained who are humanitarian workers, some people who are just tourists, because the Maduro regime doesn't really care what they are doing in Venezuela.
Manuel Tique was working for a humanitarian group called the Danish Refugee Council and was going to deliver a workshop to Venezuelan aid groups on how to monitor food distribution. But after he showed up at a border post last year, Tique was detained and held incommunicado for weeks. We lost contact with him on September 14, his sister explains, and only got news of him a month later, when Venezuelan officials spoke about him on TV and said he was a foreign mercenary. In a year, Tique has only been allowed to make 2 phone calls. He's currently in a prison known as Rodeo 1.
Es una condición supremamente desgarradora.
It's heart-wrenching, says his father, Victor Manuel. Human rights groups say that it's not clear what the Venezuelan government wants in exchange for Tique or some of the other foreigners in Venezuelan jails. But some say that as Maduro's grip on power comes under pressure, his government is likely to take more prisoners.
It's a desperation act, like your back is against a wall. You're going to kidnap as many people as you can.
David Guillam from Florida was arrested in September of last year after trying to enter Venezuela as a tourist. He was freed in January after a Trump envoy met with Maduro and discussed possible economic sanctions relief.
Given my American privilege, that kind of like made me chill out because I realized, oh, I'm not going to be here for a long time. So during my time there, I told myself, okay, let's learn about the situation that's going on and let's gather a lot of names and nationalities as possible.
But while negotiations to free prisoners have worked in some cases, they can also make things worse.
It actually creates this very dangerous environment in which anyone can be detained.
Laura Deeb is a Venezuela analyst at WOLA, a think tank in Washington. She says that the Venezuelan government has realized there are benefits from keeping international hostages.
Seeking other ways to pressure without necessarily negotiating and giving the authoritarian government what they want, it's very, very important.
Back in Bogota, the Tique family says they want the Colombian government to be more vocal about the release of its citizens and link trade and security cooperation to their freedom. But with American naval forces amassing off Venezuela's coast, officially to fight drug cartels, fears are mounting over what this show of force could mean for the prisoners, caught between diplomacy and the looming threat of confrontation. For NPR News, I'm Manuel Rueda in Bogota.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 5:30, the Up North Report, local news from our region. You can also find lots of local stories and conversations at our website, kaxe.org. We've received support from the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. Our weather tonight, widespread frost is expected, mostly clear, lows 26 to 30. Sunny tomorrow, highs 58 to 64, south winds 5 to 15. Lows tomorrow night, 42 to 46, and for Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. About 47 million Americans are food insecure. As federal food cuts take effect, more and more people are turning to food pantries. But the volunteers who run the nation's emergency food network, they're getting older. As Elaine Appleton Grant reports, a hunger crisis is about to come smack up against the country's volunteer shortage.
Phyllis Allen spends her days looking for things. She searches for potatoes at Sam's Club, cheap beets and ginger at Walmart. Today she's at Sam's Club, looking for those icons of the current American economy, affordable eggs. Alan finds them high up on the top shelf of a cooler.
That's 7½ dozen. I'll get 2 cases.
She hefts 2 huge boxes of eggs.
It is $21. It's $2.82 a dozen, which is a good price for eggs.
Every Monday, Alan shops for the Winterport, Maine food pantry she's been helping to run for 17 years. She'll bring eggs, potatoes, and bread there on Tuesday. Wednesday morning at 9, she and a tight-knit handful of volunteers will open the doors of the small, sunny building to a line of 25 or 30 people. Volunteer Pauline Botting perches on a stool next to a shelf full of pantry items.
We have bacon powders, bacon sodas, salt and pepper, cranberry sauce. If there's anything that they see that they can use, then they get it.
Nearby, 65-year-old Jeanette Benitez Ruiz stands at a table covered with local vegetables. She's wearing black splints on both wrists. She has carpal tunnel, but it's not stopping her from helping patrons.
Go ahead and grab what you need.
Thank you.
All right. Good morning, sir. How are you?
Phyllis Allen loves this. She's part inventory manager, part volunteer recruiter, part customer service specialist, part administrator, and part cheerleader. But she knows she can't do it forever.
And may I ask how old you are?
78.
You're 78 and you're running this day in, day out, huge operation.
I'm not the oldest. You know,
who's the oldest?
One is 88 and the other one I think is 89.
Volunteers like these keep America's emergency food network running. Losing even one can cripple a small pantry. But younger volunteers are harder to find than affordable eggs. Last year at Neighbor's Cupboard, an elderly driver left to care for his ailing wife. He held a crucial role, picking up food weekly from Maine's only food bank. Food banks in every state distribute free USDA and other low-cost food to agencies like Neighbor's Cupboard. The pantry needed a new driver, badly. Alan joked about it to everyone who would listen.
In each place you go, tell them that I'm looking for a hunk with a truck.
Volunteerism has declined dramatically over the last 20 years. Plus, demand for food assistance is growing. Things will get worse with cuts to the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. They're also feeling the squeeze at the Midcoast Hunger Prevention Program, which operates a food pantry in Brunswick, Maine. Last year, they put more than 650,000 meals on area dinner tables.
The average age of our volunteers is probably about 75.
Executive Director Hannah Chattelbash worries about how the pantry's 145 volunteers will feed an unprecedented number of visitors.
We consider this like impending cliff of these current volunteers who've been very dedicated for the last decade, aging out. We label that as a risk factor for our organization, absolutely.
Yeah, right now.
Back at Neighbor's Cupboard, Phyllis Allen did find her hunk with a truck. He's 67. She was thrilled. But it hardly solved the problems barreling toward them. There are the SNAP cuts, and winter's coming, meaning less food from local farmers and even more demand. Still, she always finds a way to keep things light. It's Tuesday, food delivery day. A white Toyota pickup drives up, piled with boxes.
Hunk is here.
The volunteers spring carefully into action. They're still managing to feed everyone who shows up, at least for now. For NPR News, I'm Elaine Appleton-Grant in Belfast, Maine.
Churches have long held classes to teach English to immigrants. This fall, the number of students has jumped. The reason is a change in federal policy that limits funding for some adult education programs based on students' immigration status. To find out more about this trend, the Texas Standard's Sarah Ash sat in on ESL classes at a church in Waco, Texas. She has this report.
On a Thursday morning, dozens of people gathered in Columbus Avenue Baptist Church. They were not there to worship, but to learn English. Mayar Hosseini is an engineer from Iran, and today he's learning the difference between the words wonder and wander. He's here while his wife works towards her PhD in chemistry at Baylor University.
It's a good opportunity, especially when you came to the U.S., you don't know how to speak English.
He heard about the church program from a friend.
I joined her, and after that, I'm meeting a lot of people after me.
Hosseini and his family are Muslim, but he says that doesn't matter. The church program is open to everyone who wants to learn.
One time I went to a car auction with my car.
Several church officials told NPR that they have been providing English programs for decades. But after new restrictions limited the students federally funded programs could serve based on immigration status, they've been expanding to help people who used to get this instruction elsewhere. Paula Marshall is the director of the ESL program at the Columbus Avenue Baptist Church.
The doors blew off on the first day.
She said enrollment was at 105 people in early September, compared to 84 at the beginning of last school year. In contrast, McLennan Community College across town saw their ESL enrollment drop from 181 last fall to 40 this year. Margarita Machado Casas, president of the National Association of Bilingual Education, said this group has seen a drop in enrollment at federally funded ESL programs across the country.
I'm from China.
It's unclear how many churches provide ESL programs in Texas, but Matthew Johnson, the executive director of Literacy Connexus, a nonprofit that helps churches with literacy programs, says attendance is up across the state.
I spoke with a ministry partner from a church up in Plano, and they have doubled their enrollment over what they had expected.
Literacy Connexus has tripled the number of teacher trainings they've led since mid-July, when the new Trump administration policy was announced. Jim Witt, an associate pastor at the First Baptist Church in Garland, a suburb of Dallas, said his church has also seen increased enrollment in ESL classes. Witt says although many churches are in traditionally conservative places, which are the support base for Trump's immigration policies, that doesn't influence his ministry work.
Part of following Jesus is trying to demonstrate his love to people. And one of the ways we demonstrate that love is by ministries like ESL.
Can you help me with this one? What do you see in the first one? Is that out or is that...
At Waco's Columbus Avenue Baptist Church, Phyllis Merritt said they have ESL students from 17 countries this year.
I enjoy meeting people from all over the world. I enjoy what they have taught me. To me, it is my calling. God said, love your neighbor as yourself.
For students, this program offers community and a place to learn. And Marshall said they plan to keep doing so as long as students are showing up. For NPR News, I'm Sarah Ash in Waco.
This is NPR News.
It's 529. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji, gathering at 10 a.m. Sundays now through May at the Headwaters Peace Center. HUF is an inclusive space to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Good chance for frost tonight, lows 26 to 30. Sunny tomorrow, highs 58 to 64.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Two people from Park Rapids are facing multiple felony charges for their roles in an alleged attempted murder early Saturday morning. Court documents accuse 43-year-old Charles Justice of entering a Hubbard County trailer home and stabbing a man.
Deputies responded to Piney Park around 3 a.m. on report of a man bleeding with possible stab wounds and his 5-year-old daughter screaming for help. The victim was airlifted to Fargo for treatment of his injuries. Justice allegedly admitted to using methamphetamine and believed his wife, Danielle Westfall, was having an affair with the victim. Authorities say 51-year-old Westfall eventually admitted to helping Justice dispose of the bloody clothing from the assault. A pair of blood-soaked jeans were found on the side of the road as part of the investigation in the same area where Westfall said she disposed of them. Both are set to appear in court on Monday. The state of Minnesota intends to seek a stiffer penalty than usual in the criminal sexual conduct case against a former teacher at two Iron Range schools. 43-year-old Ryan Denzer Johnson of Embarrass faces three felonies after he allegedly sexually assaulted an adolescent female relative. Denzer Johnson was most recently a high school math teacher at Mesabi East in Aurora until his resignation shortly before the charges in August. He also taught at Northeast Range in Babbitt and was involved in both schools' robotics teams. The prosecutor filed a notice of intent to seek the upward departure of sentencing guidelines based on aggravating factors. One of the factors is the victim's particular vulnerability due to her age and relationship to Denzer Johnson. The second factor listed in court documents is that the alleged offense was committed in a location in which the victim had an expectation of privacy. Denzer Johnson remains jailed in St. Louis County, and his next court appearance is Monday. The Black Duck City Council passed an amended cannabis ordinance after a lengthy public hearing on Monday. Larissa Donovan was there and has more.
The zoning amendment removes the required buffers around schools and daycares for cannabis manufacturers and cultivators, leaving the buffers in place for dispensaries. Cannabis entrepreneur Alan Bonset with his company Nobo wants to buy the former Anderson Fabrics manufacturing plant in Black Duck's industrial area, but the plant is less than 100 yards away from Black Duck Head Start, an early childhood center. With the changes approved, Nobo is that much closer to its proposed cannabis cultivation and manufacturing facility that promises up to 150 new jobs. Residents raise concerns ranging from excess phosphorus in wastewater and potential crime increases to the business's proximity to Head Start. In response, Bonset cited the company's intense security protocols and technical procedures, the industry's heavy regulation, and his company's practice of investing in their people.
We're also a company that offers employee stock options to our employees. And in fact, we are in the 97th percentile of all cannabis companies nationally as far as what our benefits offer.
Mayor Max Gillette says he checked in with his counterpart in Benton Harbor, Michigan, where Nobo purchased an old foundry, and that he felt assured that the company would do right by Black Duck.
Nobo is a company that put its money where its mouth is. And Alan's the type of person that when he says he's going to do something, he does it.
Councilmember Lori Hamilton agreed with most of the council, saying with the state's legalization, they can't manipulate ordinances to keep out cannabis.
I don't feel like this company is coming in here to wreck this town. I feel like they're a business. They have a product.
Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
Lakewood Health System will host an open house for its new cancer center 4 to 6 p.m. Friday in Staples. Hospital leaders say the addition was built to meet growing needs for rural oncology care. The new center offers things like a dedicated reception and waiting area, infusion bays, exam rooms and a procedure room, in-house scan systems, and radiation treatment technology. This is the second new cancer center in the region to open this year. Astera Health and CentraCare hosted a ribbon-cutting ceremony in Wadena in July. Without centers like these offering services, rural cancer patients often must travel long distances to get the care they need. That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Attorney General Pam Bondi was on Capitol Hill today testifying before Senate lawmakers. It was a combative hearing. Bondi defended her leadership at the Justice Department, and she dismissed allegations that she has weaponized the DOJ to go after President Trump's perceived enemies. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas was watching. He is with us now. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
Start with the Democrats on the panel. What were they focused on today?
Well, they certainly had a lot of items to choose from, but they really did zero in on what they say, and many DOJ veterans and legal observers say, has been the department's weaponization under Bondi to target Trump's political foes. The top Democrat on the committee is Illinois' Dick Durbin. Here's how he kind of summed up the Democrats' view on her leadership.
The Attorney General has systematically weaponized our nation's leading law enforcement agency to protect President Trump and his allies and attack his opponents and, sadly, the American people.
And as Exhibit A, Democrats point to the recent indictment of former FBI Director James Comey just days after the president demanded publicly that the DOJ prosecute Comey and other prominent Trump critics.
Well, and Comey has been indicted, of course, and is not the only person the president has said should be prosecuted.
That's right. There are two other people, notably, that the president publicly demanded by name in a social media post that the DOJ go after were New York Attorney General Letitia James and California Democratic Senator Adam Schiff, who's a member of the committee that Bondi was actually testifying for today.
Which makes for some interesting dynamics, which I hope we're going to get to. But let me ask you first, this allegation that Bondi has weaponized the department, when that was put to her directly, how'd she respond?
Well, look, she was specifically asked about a promise that she made at her confirmation hearing that she would maintain the Justice Department's traditional independence from the White House and keep politics out of investigations and prosecutions. Here's what she said.
I absolutely have upheld that commitment, Senator. I pledged that I would end the weaponization also of the Justice Department and that America would once again have a one-tier system of justice for all. And that is what we are doing in this country.
Now, Democrats also tried to press her on her handling of the Jeffrey Epstein files. They tried to press her on the firing of career prosecutors and FBI officials for working in Capitol riot cases or on investigations into Trump. Uh-huh. They tried to get answers about the department's decision to drop an investigation into Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, for allegedly taking a $50,000 cash bribe from an undercover FBI agent. She refused to provide answers. In many cases, she tried to deflect, actually, by going after Democratic senators themselves. Here's an exchange with California's Adam Schiff, who said that Bondi was personally attacking Democrats instead of answering questions.
Personal attacks. You've been attacking my FBI director.
But we're interested in.
He borders all.
What we're interested in is the answer to these oversight questions.
You were asked by my colleague attacking good people.
Regular order, Madam Chair, so I can ask a question.
So this was a combative hearing at times, and that exchange gives you a bit of a taste of what it was like.
It does indeed. Okay, so that's what Democrats had on their mind. What about Republican members of this committee?
Well, look, there was a huge partisan divide on this. It was like two entirely separate hearings. Republicans expressed their support for Bondi, the enormous change that she's brought to the Justice Department. They argue that the department was weaponized under the Biden administration to go after Trump and conservatives more broadly. That includes information made public this week by the panel's top Republican that the FBI back in 2023 analyzed the phone records of more than a half dozen Republican lawmakers as part of the investigation into Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Mm-hmm. They say Bondi is ending that weaponization. So despite concerns from legal observers and department veterans about the direction that the department is taking, Bondi has the political support of Republicans and the president to continue what she's doing.
Thank you, Ryan.
Thank you.
And NPR's Ryan Lucas.
Patients are clamoring to get their hands on obesity medications like Wegovy and Zepbound, but even with manufacturer discounts, their high prices can put them out of reach. So some patients are doing something they call going gray. NPR's Sydney Lupkin looked into this phenomenon for an episode of Planet Money, and she has this report.
When Phil started taking Ozempic in 2022, he was amazed at how well it worked. His blood work looked better. He was no longer pre-diabetic. He was losing weight. Ozempic is approved to treat type 2 diabetes, but is sometimes prescribed for weight loss. But he says maybe the best part was that it also quieted his addictive tendencies.
Literally, the bourbon in my freezer sat in my freezer for probably, I would say, maybe till Christmas or something like that. And I took one drink and I was like, what are you doing?
In the past, he'd had problems with prescription painkillers and alcohol. We're not using his last name or location because he could lose his job. When Phil's health insurance changed, however, it wouldn't cover Ozempic for him anymore. So instead of a $25 copay, Phil would have to pay more than $1,000 a month.
As thankful as I am for them to develop this, you know, I'm very thankful for that. But I think it's disgusting that they make this drug and that this life's changing, and then so many people can't afford it.
So he started looking online for other options. He found compounded versions of the drugs. They aren't approved by the FDA, but were allowed while obesity drugs were in short supply over the last couple of years. And he found something else, the gray market. He showed me this summer.
This is the thing it came in.
Oh, just like a box. It looks like the size of a contact lens box.
Yeah.
In his hands, Phil is holding 10 months' worth of tirzepatide, the active ingredient in Zepbound, an obesity medicine made by Eli Lilly. The little carton is covered in a mix of Chinese and English words.
Multi-fat young skin set.
What?
Yeah.
So it's disguised. Yeah.
It's disguised.
Inside the box, there are 10 little vials with big red caps. Each of them holds 30 milligrams of white powder. He makes his own medicine by mixing it with sterile water and then injects himself. In 2 years, Phil says he hasn't had any problems, but there are huge risks, including of getting contaminated or counterfeit products. That's according to Dr. Scott Isaacs, president of the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology.
They could get an infection, they could have a reaction, they could have severe side effects from dosing errors. They could also have a lack of effect. And that's probably the biggest thing that I've seen is when patients take these is that it does nothing.
Still, he says he can empathize with patients who feel like they don't have any other choice.
The bottom line is that they're really just trying to get a medication that they need.
He says it's key to communicate with your doctor, who may be able to convince insurance to cover the drug anyway. Dr. Tony Cirillo is the president of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He says ER doctors have seen patients with complications from taking either gray market or compounded obesity medicines, but they don't always say which.
Look, we, particularly in the emergency department, we take care of a lot of people who have done a lot of things that maybe not was their proudest moment. It doesn't matter to us.
He says they're there to take care of patients, and getting the full story is a big help.
So these are not benign medications without proper monitoring and supervision.
Cirillo says do not hesitate to go to the ER if you think you're having an emergency. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com.
You're listening to All Things Considered. Colorado had some major wildfires this summer. The danger is mostly over now, but for ranchers, recovering from the fires may prove more challenging than surviving them, as Colorado Public Radio's Dan Boyce reports.
It takes an all-terrain vehicle to trundle up the rocky trails and access the country 64-year-old cattle rancher Janie Van Winkle works on the Uncompahgre Plateau.
We were seeing 70 to 100-foot flames coming up over that ridge.
5 major Colorado wildfires burned an area nearly the size of Atlanta this summer, including large swaths of public and private lands farmers and ranchers like Van Winkle need to make a living.
There is absolutely nothing but rocks and these skeletons of trees. It's an eerie landscape.
About 60% of the U.S. Forest Service land her family leases for cattle grazing burned. In her pickup, Van Winkle says they were able to haul out their 1,500 cows and calves down narrow, twisting roads to safety 10 miles south.
Without a doubt, it's the hardest thing we've ever done. And the hardest part is we're not done.
A lot of these landowners, they just got out of the thick of it.
Reese Melton works for Rio Blanco County. A couple dozen ranchers have reached out to his office for aid so far. It's hard to gauge how many were affected.
That was a heavy lift for these folks to protect their property, protect their livestock, and get them out of harm's way. So they have a lot of work ahead of them to assess the damages.
Monsoon rains that did help drench the flames soon led to widespread flash flooding.
You don't have this level of ecological disturbance without some things being changed on the landscape long term.
The state estimates more than $27 million in losses in Rio Blanco County. Power line infrastructure critical to local oil and gas operations, washed out roads, and burn scars that may take years to heal and provide adequate grazing for ranchers again. FEMA did cover 75% of the state's cost to put the fires out, but more federal aid is needed for the recovery, Melton says, and that will take time.
One of the biggest lifts of this situation is putting all the puzzle pieces together.
Depending on the property's ownership and its use, a rancher might apply to the Bureau of Land Management, the Natural Resource Conservation Service, the Farm Service Agency, and other state and federal agencies.
They all operate within their own different boxes, and they have different programs, and they have different assessments, and they have different funding sources.
And that's when those agencies are operating at all. Many aid programs are on pause during the federal government shutdown. Back on the Uncompahgre Plateau, long strands of barbed wire lay limp and discolored in the ash. Janie Van Winkle pulls up a handful of thick metal staples, the only remaining evidence of a wooden fence post.
That wire won't ever work again.
Lost fencing is often one of the biggest wildfire costs for ranchers.
In normal circumstances, a mile of four-strand barbed wire fence will cost about $20,000.
Van Winkle estimates they lost about 7 miles. She expects the U.S. Department of Agriculture to pay for new fencing materials and maybe help out with labor. But there's still a lot of arduous physical work ahead for her family, stretching new wires across steep and blackened mountainsides. For NPR News, I'm Dan Boyce from Colorado's Western Slope.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's 5:48. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, we will hear how birding groups are banding together with government agencies and others to form one united front to tackle migrating birds colliding with buildings. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and at 7, Eric Otto, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support for KAXE comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses, including cloud solutions, cybersecurity services, network management, and more, all with local customer service and support. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Widespread frost tonight, clear, lows 26 to 30, and tomorrow, sunny, highs 58 to 64. Our lows tomorrow night, not quite as chilly, 42 to 46, and looking ahead to Thursday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid to upper 60s. Pine River Market Square will hold an indoor growers and crafters market on Saturday from 10 to 2 at the warehouse on Norway Avenue in Pine River. Local band Every Bird will provide live music. The Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation announces the Itasca Area 100 Plus Women Who Care Giving Circle on Monday, October 13th at Timberlake Lodge. Registration starts at 5, program at 5:30. Attendees each contribute $100 and nonprofits are nominated to receive the collective donation. Find more information and register on Facebook. United Way of Bemidji will distribute coats for the community this Saturday, 9 to noon at First Lutheran Church on Bemidji Avenue North. Anyone in need of winter items is welcome. There's more ahead from All Things Considered on People Powered KAXE.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. We are in the height of the fall migration season. Hundreds of millions of birds are taking to the skies every evening. They fly south through the night, navigating with the help of the moon and the stars. One of the biggest threats they face is glass. Window glass is either invisible or it reflects the trees and sky. So when birds are migrating, lots and lots of birds crash into windows. Efforts to prevent this have recently taken on some new momentum. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce explains why.
Just after dawn, downtown Washington, D.C. is quiet. Very few cars are on the streets. Stephanie Haley is walking next to an office building, scanning the sidewalk. There's pieces of trash, leaves, and then...
This looks like it might be a bird.
A tiny olive green songbird is huddled there. It's alive, but not moving. Until it's gently covered with a net. This Acadian flycatcher was on its way to Central or South America. Then it hit this glass-covered building. Now, despite its protests, it's going inside a brown paper bag.
Okay. This is a good sign, the fluttering, which means that hopefully he's got enough, you know, he's just stunned. And I'll take him to City Wildlife, and the doctors will check him out.
City Wildlife is a local rescue service. When I call them later, they say they tried to treat this bird. They even put it in an oxygen chamber, but it died. Most collision victims don't survive. It's estimated that at least a billion birds die this way every year in the U.S. They have brain injuries, broken bones.
I mean, they can be flying like up to 30 miles an hour when they hit the glass. So it's a very loud thunk.
That's Lisbeth Fuse. She and Stephanie Haley are part of a group called Lights Out DC that walks a set route through the city every single morning during migration season, trying to find dead or injured birds before the rats get them or before custodians sweep them away. Their work shows that a half dozen buildings seem to be death traps.
Yeah, this is a problematic building.
On North Capitol Street, there's an office complex that wraps around a plaza with two sections that converge on a big glass atrium. Fuse says that birds get funneled towards a multi-story wall of glass.
And you see how the reflection works? It looks like you could keep going.
On top of the revolving door, she spots a small dead bird. That's where it fell after hitting the glass wall.
So that's a pretty common window collision victim. That is a female yellowthroat.
She carefully records the death. Similar data collection efforts are going on across the country, in places like Chicago, Philadelphia, Dallas, San Diego. The goal is to reveal the scale of a problem that's mostly invisible, though occasionally something dramatic happens.
An unusual situation at McCormick Place today. Nearly 1,000 birds found dead.
On the night of October 4th, 2023, hundreds of migrating birds slammed into McCormick Place Convention Center in Chicago. This made headlines nationwide. Tina Phillips is with the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
People who never even thought about birds were suddenly like, wait a minute, 1,000 birds died in one night crashing into one building?
This incident inspired the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to convene a big summit, inviting birding groups, government agencies, architecture firms, and dark sky groups that want to minimize artificial light. Phillips says they'd all been trying to prevent birds from hitting buildings, but separately.
And so coming out of that meeting, we knew we needed to keep working together to really try to make this impact meaningful.
They recently formed the Bird Collision Prevention Alliance. More than 100 organizations have joined, including federal agencies. They've now got working groups that meet frequently. This comes as the Trump administration has weakened federal protections for migratory birds. But members say this alliance isn't about pushing policy at the national level.
We're just focusing on the science, and we're focusing on what's the best way to save
birds at scale without getting bogged down in political conversations.
Brian Lenz is with the American Bird Conservancy. He says in the past, it wasn't really known how to keep birds away from glass.
People used to say, put a hawk decal on your window and it's good because the birds will be scared of that. The only thing that does is keep the birds from hitting the hawk decal.
He says now there's new kinds of glass and window treatments that have been shown to really work. Take that convention center in Chicago. Patrick Allen is the chief operating officer.
We were a big piece of glass sitting right out on the lake. So, and there's no doubt the reflections would attract the birds.
After the high-profile mass collision, managers decided to put an easy-to-install product on the windows.
It's just nothing but a film with dots in a particular pattern. You put it on the window, and you pull the film back off, and the dots stay on.
This treatment reduced bird collisions by 95%.
You know, the numbers are awesome. We're very proud of it.
Doing this cost over $1 million. He says that's only because they had a huge expanse of glass, enough to cover 2 football fields. Back in downtown D.C., a volunteer named Stephanie Dahlke is searching the ground for the stunned and the dead. She says some buildings here have made changes, like turning off nighttime lights that can attract the birds.
You would think that most buildings would care and want to fix the problem, although it turns out that it can be complicated and expensive to treat a commercial building.
And because birds tend to hit windows down low, below the tree line, a big part of the problem is smaller buildings and houses.
Which is why it's great to just educate everybody about the topic, because you can fix it at home, too.
She tells me that D.C. recently passed a bird-friendly building law. It's one of only a few major cities in the nation to do so. But the law only applies to new construction, not what's already here, like this skyway she shows me. It connects 2 buildings, and it's made of mirrored glass.
We call this the walkway of death. So this is a very deadly spot.
There on the ground is a dead ruby-throated hummingbird. It's tiny, the size of her thumb, with iridescent green feathers. It still had a long way to go on its migration.
It's just, it boggles the mind to think that these little guys can fly over the Gulf of Mexico. Just how do they manage that? It's amazing. But then we take them out with some glass.
She notes the location and date so this bird can go in their database. She takes a photo. Her cell phone is filled with hundreds of pictures of window collision victims. And then she keeps walking, looking for more and hoping not to find them. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Drexel University, whose cooperative education program positions students to explore future careers before graduation. This is experiential education. More at drexel.edu. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers, dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR be the model for high-quality journalism in the 21st century. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thanks for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thanks for your support. Coming up as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and 7 o'clock, Eric Otto, your volunteer host for On the River. Frost is likely tonight, lows 26 to 30. Support comes from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, dedicated to conserving the rich ecological landscape of Minnesota, offering membership